Hey there, I was reading this morning about a criminal who went to college to learn how to program in order to steal all of Microsoft's C++ code. Very, very sad story. That guy had to take a lot of classes. Hey, howdy, howdy, ho! It's Daniel Markham here, Nerd Roundup, with some of the worst dad nerd jokes you've ever heard in your life. If you've never been to a Nerd Roundup before, you haven't missed a damn thing, but we're happy you're here today. Nerd Roundup is just at the end of each week, we sit back and look at the tech articles for that week, shoot the shit, have fun. I believe a team that can relax and have fun together can do damn near anything together. And the only way to really show you how to do that is just to show you. You can't teach somebody how to get along with folks. So I try to find as many people as I can with differing political and technical opinions and just throw them all in one room and see what happens. So this week we have John Kerr. John, good to see you.
Great joke. You take a lot of classes.
I got that. Woo-hoo. Yeah, I still like my Monad joke from a couple months back. I don't think I told that one. Everybody's kind of going.
Yeah, you kind of have to know what a Monad is.
When you're a dad, you have to just keep retelling those dang jokes until finally somebody laughs at them.
That's true. Yeah.
What have you been up to this week, John?
Oh, well, working with a fun group, started doing a workshop, we call them Agile Mentoring Workshop. And in one of the side conversations, I learned about something that maybe we'll be able to help them with after the workshop. The workshop is just ostensibly about kind of helping them with, you know, how do they deliver value, things like that. And, you know, just, you know, help them come up with a better process. And along the way, I discovered, we were talking about feature flippers and a little side conversation, talking about, do you have feature flippers? Do you have ways to, you know, allow these new features that you're building for a client for a sale to work maybe just for that client, because that's kind of how I've done things for the past 20 years or so, is SaaS apps, client configured capabilities and feature flippers and things like that. Not only for development, but sometimes actually for turning things on and off for a client.
Yes.
Oh, we kind of have that, but it usually doesn't work so well because our normal mode is it's always on. So then sometimes when we want to turn it off, it goes a little haywire. I'm like, oh, well, maybe just flip that attitude around and make it off by default. And, you know, then you probably solve that problem. And I said, so when you deliver to your clients, like I'm used to building apps that are, I have a single server, so to speak, single deploy, and it services all my clients. And that's where the feature flipper. So when you deploy to your clients, what do you do? How does it work? Oh, no, we actually, every client has its own server, its own deploy.
God, I'm like, I was thinking that. I didn't think they were going to, I've seen that a lot. I've seen that several times. Because they make different sales, and every time they make a sale, they reconfigure the software product.
Yeah, new features, build things. So I need to dig into that a little more, but that, you know, they said, oh, he's making a face. Yeah, so I was like, when you hit 1,000 clients, how's it going to work for you? It's not very scalable. So, but a lot of people start off in startups and do things that technical debt. I always say it's not bad if you are wielding it for a purpose. Like, don't try to build something perfect right away. Like when you're just still trying to make money and survive. But at some point in the last, you know, one company was the last 20 years, you know, and another, this company's like some point in the last 14 years, it would have been nice to have started paying off some of that technical debt.
Yeah.
Because now it's, you know, anyway, that's what I'm working on.
I really like the idea, the idea of the per client feature flipping. That's, we don't talk enough about how fine grained you can make feature flags. It's a really cool point. I had a work with a local startup who I think they had 50 different deployed versions of their product. It would be just not, my best advice to folks is to do what it takes to make the sale, because starving is no fun. But put in code cleanup as part of your work ethic, and you know, don't go home. You're not done because you made the sale. You're done when the code's right. I mean,
that's a good way to put it.
The business is done when it made the sale. You just got fed for the week, but you're not done because you still got stuff to do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully I'll get a chance to help them navigate out of this mess, so to speak. And I will get up every so often. I've just got to stir my onion soup. So
I had a kind of fun times last week. We skipped last week's nerd roundup because, as I was telling you offline, my wife, the day before Nerd Roundup, fell and shattered her arm, and she went to the doctor, and golly gee, we stayed up all night, and we had surgery, emergency surgery the next day, and it was no fun. It was just no fun at all. And since then, I have been her left-hand man because she has no left arm. So whenever something requires two hands, I'm the guy. And to be honest, I've been playing a hell of a lot of Factorio for the last week or so. I can't work if I'm going to be called like at random times to do things. My brain doesn't work that way.
I get it. Yeah, the random interrupt.
Yeah. And to be honest, Factorio is very, very much a nerd crack. So I actually thought about making an essay on how Factorio can teach you to write good microservices. And I'm tempted on this one because I think it would be really cool, and I could do live videos from the game and everything. Maybe so.
What is it? I'm not familiar with it.
Well, Factorio is a game where you find yourself on a planet. The frame story: you're on a planet, you have no technology, and then, like many other games, you start gathering resources. But after you gather the resources, you build a factory with conveyor belts, and the factory may be like an oven to turn the coal into electricity or various things, and it ends up with this tree of stuff, each of which is done by automation, each of which has a different input and output. This thing sort of sounded like function, maybe. And your job is to wire them all together in the most efficient manner possible. So there have been people who recommend sort of the bus approach, which would be like an event messaging system. There are people who build modular approach, where you have a certain goal and you just build the factories around that goal. It's very, very much related to microservices. It's just I don't know if I could cover the whole ground of both Factorio and microservices at the same time, but it would be a cool idea.
Yeah, that's interesting. Huh. Does sound like it could be addictive. Yeah.
Very much so, because each factory has a different rate that goes in and out. Hey, we got somebody else is here. Who is here? We don't know.
It looks like Diego.
He's like, hey, Diego, we can't see you, but I don't think we're supposed to see you. So I'm hoping you can watch us, because how do I do this now? Da-da-da-da-da. If this works, Diego, we're eventually going to go with real-time chatting. How do I do that? I see if I can disable your video. Right? No. Dang it. Okay. Never mind. Technical. Going to work right now. So that was, as you can imagine, that was just, who can have more fun than going to the hospital and playing video games. I didn't get very much useful done at all. I'm sorry to say that.
That's all right. You're helping your wife recover.
This is my job. My number one job is family. My number two job is other stuff. So, too many years reversing that around. Okay. It's a work in progress. Okay.
Yes,
all right. Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to capture the whole screen, and then we'll just have it bounce around however it wants to bounce around. Diego, I don't know if you can hear us or not, but I tried to set it so that everybody could listen but not participate this time. If you can hear me, that's what's happening. If you can't hear me, then you can't hear me. So that's all good either way. This will work no matter what happens. So let's hit off the articles here. All right. The first one is really, really super cool. This is a guy did a show HN matrix CRDT with a CRDT with a matrix backend. And for those of you who don't know the buzzwords, CRDT is a conflict-free replicated data type. Basically, CRDTs are a way to make computer types such that they can go asynchronously over an event stream and still you're eventually consistent at the other end. That's the way Google Docs works. When all the people are editing at the same time, you're wondering how that works? That's CRDT. That's a way to do synchronization of multiple object graphs. So this guy took the CRDT idea, plugged it into the Matrix platform. If you don't know what Matrix is, Matrix is, I think, run by the Freedom FEE electronic folks. It is a end-to-end encrypted messaging system that's technically should be unbreakable by anybody. So it's an open platform. So he's basically created a library to replicate object graphs in a secure way, point to point, that nobody can intercept.
Wow.
Yeah, I think my comment was sometimes buzzwords can collide and good things happen. This is it's just freaking awesome. The more I think about this, the more awesome I think it's going to be. It's got the what do they call it? The YJS library. So the GitHub link is here. He's got a live demo of doing the editing. He's got to-do list. He talks about how to set it up. I think probably right now to play around with, the biggest problem is going to be actually hooking into the Matrix back end and doing this. Because it's encrypted, I think setup's going to be a bear for coders. But in general, this is a super, super cool idea. I would love to play with this. I really, really would. This would be top of my list, along with the next thing we're going to talk about at the end. This is way awesome. Then you can imagine any place you've got an object graph that needs synchronization, you can use this. You could use this any kind of client server app that you used to have. You can do the messaging, email, anything has an object graph.
I remember probably 10 plus years ago, I'm sure it's still around, Meteor. It was, I think it was Mongo and JavaScript, stuff like that. But yeah, it similar demo where you could, just like his in the Git repo, he has the something over here and shows up over here. And I'm not sure what the back end was per se, or if it was CRDT or not. It's a cool, when you need that sort of sync, that's pretty cool tech.
Yeah, it changes the design around. The Haskell guys and the math guys or category theory guys are now talking about linear types. And a linear type is a type that begins one way and can shift in a certain way, but can't go back, which is a CRDT, basically. It's a linear type. So I think this has been around in various forms for 20 years, but now they're getting the generic libraries and the type system in place. It is going to be something to really look forward to in the next 5 or 10 years.
Cool.
Yeah, I would really love to play with this. But the thing is, having said I really want to play with it, and I love the tech, what would you do? Spend 2 or 3 days getting all the library set up so you can do my document. And he's got the GIF here. I mean, it's fun to do shared documents, but not 2 or 3 days worth of coding fun. If I had some end goal, some product in mind that would be worthwhile, hell yeah, I would jump into this, but not just to do Hello World.
Not just to force it into an app.
Yeah. And I think so many bad apps we see are the results of architects going, hey, this is really cool, let's get the hammer out and put it in our next. It's like, no. I keep saying this, and you've heard me 100 times. You have to let the tech force the structure. The market need has to force the tech out. You can't take the tech and hit the market with it. It's not going to work. So this is a very important story, this next one. You mentioned it offline. Scientists in Israel have trained goldfish to drive on land. Now, you're probably wondering where the goldfish go. They're like Burger King there's not any dry food goldfish stores I know of. But yeah, they built a little aquarium with a set of cameras. They've got a how to do it yourself if you want to build your own goldfish car. If this wasn't silly enough, and their point being that the fish are smart enough to drive around. I was reading this, and it gets even better because down here near the bottom it says, where's this at? Blah, blah, blah. This is not the only one they've done this. They've actually had here we go. Dogs and rats have their own cars that they've created. And who would not want to see a dog driving down the highway? I mean, it's something I would... I mean, there's a truck driver shortage right now. You get a bunch of golden retrievers, you could maybe fix this thing.
Or maybe you know, big burly St. Bernards.
Yeah. Well, they're already doing the Swiss Alps thing with the barrel.
Yeah. They come with their own brandy.
Yeah. I guess from a cognitive standpoint, this makes sense. Heck, I don't know. They pay scientists to do all sorts of strange things that I do not know. I do not grok.
I remember I read a book years ago, maybe 09 or 07, something like that, called like the I think it was called the Israel Test. Hmm. And it talks about it had some insights into, I saw the Ben Gurion University, the kind of the crazy tech and the crazy research that comes out of Israel and some of their high, you know, their high level tech, I don't know if their universities or institutions are insane, like with some of the things. They've invented tons of goofy things that we use every day on the internet. Oh, wow. So yeah, it's funny. The next generation of self, not self-driving.
Nah, yeah, I don't, I think they're, this is one in a series of stories about exploring how animals reason about things. I saw something a week or two ago that they think crows are able to reason about their own reasoning. So crows understand they're thinking about things.
Crows are super smart. They're what, COVIDs or something like that?
Corvids, yes.
Corvids. There you go. I guess COVID is.
Yeah, they're not COVID.
Yeah, that's something else that's in the recent vernacular. Yeah, they're super smart. Magpies, corvids.
Yeah, they did the thing with the three-card Monty where they hide the thing around the shell and the crows could always spot it. They say that if you make a crow angry, if you like hurt it in some way, all the friend crows will remember that and come and squawk at you. It's weird. It's a weird
thing. It's fun to watch them fight for air superiority. And, we live... like a big 80-acre field and just one neighbor type thing. So we're out in the country and there's a lot of red-tailed hawks and other birds. And man, when you see the crows and the hawks doing like aerial combat and the crows they're cool. And even as a kid, as a teenager, when sometimes we would hunt and go after crows, they're super smart. There's two scouts.
I think they call it convergent evolution. It's an example of the dinosaurs in this case, a completely separate species that also is involved some sort of intelligence. This next story, I saw this on Reddit the other day. This guy said, "Hey, I took my lockdown time during the pandemic and I built a website that will show you what the supply chain looks like for any of the major U.S. brands. So you go to Walmart and it will show you all the shipments Walmart has received and all the containers and how many and from which countries and what kind of goods there were." It's a supply chain analysis graphing tool.
That's crazy.
Isn't that wild? So you can.
I hope he shared it with the companies.
I guess maybe the shipping data is public domain. I'm sure he couldn't have got this. The companies would have never agreed to it, I don't think. Yeah, that's wild stuff. So the next story is on the new GitHub roadmap. They're going to enable mermaid diagrams in Markdown. And I didn't know what a mermaid diagram, I didn't really never wanted to diagram a mermaid myself. But so I looked this up, and it turns out that mermaid is a way of describing, it looks like UML type diagrams in Markdown. So you can just kind of go in and say, "Oh, okay, this is, here's my graph thing, or here's my sequence diagram," and you put it in Markdown in very simple text. Here's the text right here, and it automatically draws the thing for you.
Yeah, it for a long time I used something called UMLET, like UML let, and it's just like that, where the diagram is text. So it's a very similar parser, and you can edit the text and the diagram will change, or you can use, there's a little UI that you can use. So it's, I wonder if it's similar to this particular tech.
Yes, it is. I think the deal is that it's text-based, but then there's a JavaScript library. So you know, the web page that you're going to sends your diagram text, and then on the browser, the library turns that into the Google diagram. So the diagram is not rendered somewhere else and sent to you.
Yes. It's similar to the, UML. That's cool.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I decided, I guess in the 90s with Rational Rose and Irwin and all those kind of cool diagramming tools we had, they were really cool, but the problem was version control and collaboration, and I would rather go to just straight text, and so I'm sure a lot of people came to the same conclusions.
Well, that's why we created TogetherSoft, because it had, like, the early versions had RCS built in, like the really early version of version control. And it was simultaneously, so the code and the diagrams were always in sync. Basically, the secret sauce was always listening to the file change, whether an IDE made the file change or you edited the file change outside. Poof, let me redraw the diagram. So it looked like magic, but touching the diagram and adding an attribute or a class created something in the file system, which then it reread it. And that, right? So it looked magical, always in sync, never out. Because, in the early days, I'd be like, my class diagrams in PowerPoint and my sequence diagrams in Excel. Okay, it's a good way to get some ideas on the paper, but they soon got out of sync with the real code.
Yes.
And enter TogetherSoft's, control center and things like that.
That's reminds me of the old DocView model that Microsoft had for a while, and it's the same thing. It's that it's also a model view model that you've got our model view controller. You've got some object graph yet again. That's in your case, it'd be the files, and that object graph is changing, and that kicks off the view change, which is the diagram. It's odd because your model is actually not the model on the that's the picture of the model. Right. The model is actually the files.
Yeah, it's all sleight of hand, so to speak.
I've got kind of mixed feelings about. I'm really happy they're putting some sort of diagramming in. That's really cool. However, I talked to some mutual friends, and I think I'm going to be speaking at a TED thing this year. And as part of that, I was creating a way to diagram enterprise microservices, and I use something called GraphViz, and that's been around for 20 years, and it is just a diagram.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. So my problem is that not that I spent the week doing GraphViz, but I can go back and do Mermaid, but the Mermaid is a typed system. So you call out a sequence diagram, and then it knows you're doing sequence diagram stuff. GraphViz is a layout system. So a lot of times, a lot of UML tools will have the UML thing up front, and then to convert it to GraphViz in the background. Having that back end was freed me up to do my own kind of diagramming, and now I've got to figure out like how to bolt it into whatever they decide a diagram should be, and I don't like that. And I also worry about, once you start throwing some typed information around what these diagrams are we going to see scrapers come through, and for instance pull off class diagrams or sequence diagrams, and then get some sort of AI off of that. Just A lot of things I don't like about that.
Yeah.
And here you've got some great examples, but Mermaid itself looks super duper cool, and the idea, super duper cool. It occurs to me you can't see me, can you?
I can.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. All right.
I see you, and I see the diagram behind you. Yep.
Yeah, it's a way cool diagramming. GitHub did this thing, and they were joking about it years ago. They're like, eventually GitHub's going to start harvesting code, and damn if that's exactly what they ended up doing this past year, is going through and having the Markov change around everybody's code, and then making a code helper out of that. There's a lot of business intelligence stuck in GitHub repositories all over, not just keys to servers, just all kinds of really sensitive, interesting stuff.
Yeah, that's probably not untrue. Yeah, a lot of domain models.
Oh, domain models. A lot of org charts. Like I said, once you start telling the system what sort of chart it is instead of just how to lay it out, then you're actually providing key information to a third party. I don't know. Maybe I'm just paranoid. I don't know. So this next story is firing upheld for LAPD officers playing Pokemon Go instead of responding to a robbery.
So, no way.
Yeah, they were trying to get a Snorlax, and I guess a Snorlax is hard to get. And meanwhile, a couple blocks away, a store is getting robbed, and they're like driving around trying to, with their GPS, trying on their cell phones. The captain comes and finds them, and they're like, "Hey, we never heard the call." And so they played the, they've got tapes, they played the tape back, and the tape consisted of like a half hour of them going, "Hey, how do we get this next little game?" It was, they were not being policemen, they were being Pokemon players.
It's addictive.
Yes. Yeah,
they should have been doing Factio at home.
Factorio, yeah. I wonder if the programmer who eventually writes the code, yeah, that guy going to be responsible for those cops not showing up and somewhat culpable, maybe culpable, not responsible.
Yeah, no.
So this takes us to the next essay, which I almost, my week was too chaotic to write a reply to this, but this was fascinating stuff. This guy wrote the code I'm still ashamed of, and he talks about when he worked in a Canadian software company, he wrote some code that would give teenage girls a test to see whether or not they needed a drug or not, and no matter what they answered, they needed the drug. And he still feels guilty. Some girls had killed themselves. He feels really, really bad about it.
Oh, wow.
So that gets back to this. I mean, you joke about the Snorlax, because obviously policemen are supposed to be responsible, but teenage girls and drug, there's a line somewhere. There is this isn't just fun and games to the end. At some point you cross the line.
Yeah, the not being able to have self-control and playing a video game. Yeah, they could have been playing cards too. That's different, but yeah, because I do wonder about some of the things that are going on, especially nowadays with tech and making really bad decisions on their end about other people. Is there some kind of accountability? And writing a test that always comes back one way to, yeah, do something to promote a drug. When Pfizer abandoned the control arm of the vaccine study about the time when it starts to lose efficacy, coincidentally, you might say that was, oh, you just want to make sure that everybody gets the vaccine. Or you might say, wait, they're experts at doing this. That wasn't a mistake. Yeah, so when you do something like that has real impact, yeah, it's kind of like, do you feel a little dirty?
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison to the regulatory state. I think there's a good comparison because, you know, we want controls because we think we need protection, so we create these regulatory systems. And we want to know things, so we create these technology systems to tell us stuff. But what ends up doing, no matter how hard we try, we end up giving those systems we've created the ability to rubber stamp things to say that they are good and true. So the FDA is not only this thing that takes all this time to approve stuff, it's also an organization that says, bam, it is good. Is good, you can have it now. And right. that's what these guys were. That's why they abandoned the control arm, because they knew they were going to get the FDA approval, and that's the magic stuff.
Yeah.
So this brings up a lot of stuff. I did not take a job 20 years back with a cigarette company because I felt that morally I did not want to write code to help people smoke. I understand other people feel differently. I would have no problem writing code to blow people up in various places. But surveillance code, probably, I would not. So you gotta work through, and you gotta work through the difference between morals, like the things I'm okay with, and ethics, the things as a group of programmers we're okay with. There's different things entirely.
Yeah, and I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you should be able to choose, of course.
So this TV star retires from selling farts after she has a heart attack. And I picked this because I read this and I thought to myself, what in the living fuck is going on here? This nice-looking woman has come up with a job some sort of online thing to flatulate into little jars and sell them. And she said she's making, well, she made over $200,000. She made over $50,000 in 1 week. But then she had a heart attack. I don't know. I didn't get to read the bottom of this, and maybe she farted herself. It was a weird, weird story. And I'm like, the guys who built these tech engines had no idea at all what they would be used for. It's like, wow. Who could have predicted?
Nobody.
Yeah.
And that's just it. It's, you know, it's funny. I was talking with my UK colleague, and, you know, some funny thing about, yeah, the internet's, isn't the internet a great thing? I said, yeah, kind of. Yeah. Yeah. But, and then we had a little conversation a little bit later, like, yeah, about that. It's a tool.
Yeah.
Just like Jira. Jira is a tool. Jira is not evil. Jira is not sentient. It's not trying to screw your life as a developer. Now, maybe whoever configured it is, but same thing with the internet. Yeah, it's just might expose people, but people is people, and not all people is good people. And there's,
I agree,
unfortunately, it's easier to see all kinds of good and bad and indifferent things.
I agree with your assessment. I think to add to that, where I see the problems occurring, and you can go back to the Germans, the Nazi state, as far back as you want to go. The way we end up with these really evil systems is when people put the blinders on and say, okay, well, overall the system may be good or bad, but my little part is, you know, I wrote the Snorlax code. I'm not worried about whether somebody gets robbed. You know, I wrote the selling code. It's fine if people. So it's, we tend to scope down the impact of our work to the point that we don't have to worry about any kind of bigger picture stuff. And I don't think that's the appropriate thing for us to do. I don't have any answers here. I'm just saying that it concerns me.
Yeah.
It's not the internet's a tool. It's the internet's like a big, humongous storage chest full of 1,000 different tools, some with little sharp edges, some got the motors on them, they got like nuclear fusion machines. And, you know, we just.
That's true.
Yeah, hey, take this and mow your grass. And yeah, it probably will. It might hurt a little bit.
All right. I cut your toes off.
Yeah, but your grass will get mowed. This next story is. They finally did a merge pull request for the OCaml multi-core system. If you're not familiar with this, OCaml is the object-oriented meta language. It's been around, 30 years. Researchers wanted to put together a language that could actually imitate and handle and reproduce every other language, and they came up with ML, and OCaml is the object version of that. F-sharp, by the way, is the Microsoft version of this. But OCaml, for a long time, refused to do multi-core stuff. And the reasoning being, hey, if you've got pure functions that are tightly written, multi-core doesn't do anything for you at all, because your code and your functions going to each, the processor will divide it up amongst the cores anyway. And so who cares? And I think they finally came to their senses, or came around, when people started talking about cloud computations and distributed processing. And at some point, they're like, okay, well, yeah, we can't be really sure that each of these things will be split up by the processing system, so let's dive in and see how we write a meta language to handle all sort of asynchronous parallel code. And this is it. They've finally got it in. It took them about 10 years.
Yeah, somehow I remember that acronym from a long time ago.
When I learned F-Sharp, F-Sharp was Microsoft's OCaml. There were no F-Sharp books. I had to go buy the OCaml books to learn F-Sharp. It's a cool little language. If you better like recursion, that's all I have to say.
I love recursion. Recursion is super powerful.
It is. I have to get my head in the right spot. I was coding Bob a while back, and Bob was like, "Oh, I see you're writing the degenerate case." I'm like, "Hey, watch it, Bob. Hey, you're friends."
Yeah, stop throwing the. Yeah, who asked you?
Yeah, of course, the drink case would be, I guess, a null set or whatever on your recursion.
Yeah.
But I was not used to having somebody tell me I was writing degenerate code. That didn't go over too well. And if you're interested in parallel programming, first off, the tech weenie part of this. So to do parallel cloud processing at scale, they had to determine how you could write a pure function that goes away to some other place and comes back, and you have some way of reasoning about the code. And of course, we run functions anywhere right now, but they wanted to be able to strongly type the system from that point on out. And to do that, they came up, well, they started using something called algebraic effects. And there's a really, really cool article in the link. I will oversimplify. Oversimplifying says, I call your function returns an algebraic type. So say you want a random number. I'll give you an integer, or I will give you a file error code, or, you know, out of memory code. And that's the only damn thing you're going to get from me. So it's not like we call into the OS and all these things happen. It's like, you call my function, I'm going to contract with you the only things you get back. And then you can reason about them in the code without having to actually call that function. It's cool stuff.
Yeah. The result simply returns a value and doesn't cause an effect.
Yeah. Exactly. It reminds me of the old H result in the COM plus libraries from C++. It was... You didn't get like an integer, you got an H result integer, which was maybe I got something, maybe I don't. You have to actually go into that type and it'll tell you whether or not it worked or not. I also have a link of a bunch of different programming languages and how fast they do ray tracing.
I remember they doing ray tracing eons ago. Yeah, cool stuff. That would take 2 hours, you know, on some probably a 286 or a 386 or something like that, a long time ago.
Oh, like overnight sometimes, huh?
Sometimes, yeah, for a complex model, yeah. But it was cool. Yeah.
Folks out there, if you want to do a super, like, duper nerdy, like, romp, start with the Doom guys. And go, because what they wanted to do was a first-person shooter where you could see the world around. Nobody had ever done that before. And the technical way is to do ray tracing. Who the hell can do ray tracing on 386? So you start off with how ray tracing works, and then the fun begins because they start talking about how they're hacking their way to make it work. And that's a bunch of cool tech stories.
I bet. Yeah.
At one point, they need to do it's a square root of a number or cosine of a number, and they realized that they could just do a shift to, or there was some kind of weird arithmetic operation that would get them close enough that it didn't matter. So they just did the register operation and kept going.
Yeah, there's sometimes we did crazy things.
Even on the cyber supercomputer to turn stuff into good enough table lookups, like, because you can even do that for, you know, complicated math things. You know, if you can turn it into something that's accurate enough, then it's faster than some computation.
Well, yeah, one of the things I remember realizing was that for a lot of floating point calculations, you really don't care about more than like 2 or 3 digits. So you could do a quick 100 item lookup table. Hit the right spot, interpolate between the two values, and, you know, 10 operations later, you're on your way. And that's close enough. Yeah.
And we had some crazy, especially for like the normal aerodynamic models for the F-14, you know, we had model, but then we, for flat spins, we actually had some crazy ass data from a vertical wind tunnel.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of empirical data from because sadly, the F-14, unlike when I, you know, you've probably done spins, when I did spins in a Cessna, it's kind of just like a spiral, you know, feels like you're just a spiral dive. But the F-14 falls like a maple leaf. It literally is a 90 degree angle of attack. I mean, you basically see that as you're looking, you're also 23 feet in front of the, you know, like on the end of the string. So you just see the horizon bouncing. So that was a very strange aerodynamics to model.
Is that recoverable?
You know, what's that?
Could they? Was there a way to get out?
Yeah, I would take people through how to recover. Yeah, I could recite it now. I did it so often. Yeah, roll SAS off, right? Roll stability augmentation system off to get full throw of the big ass. Like their big ass stabilators were the size of like an A4's wing, right? They called it the F-14 the aluminum cloud because it's this giant airplane. You know, the engines are far apart. Anyway. But the cool thing was we took that data and turned that into a multi-dimensional function table lookup. You know, not even just 3 dimensions. I mean, sometimes it was some crazy ass dimensions that we had there, the data from the wind tunnel. So we just built a, exactly what you said, like a, you can imagine a multi-dimensional, you know, some, you might be in between these five dimensions that you have, and it's a, you know, the value is somewhere right in between all that. So yeah, it was the easiest, it was just dumb and simple and fast on a 60-bit cyber supercomputer.
I remember when I took my spin training, the guy actually, he actually wrote the book on spins, but he was talking about the difficult ones were the twins. And like you said, the farther the engines are from the axis, once you start going, the centrifugal force becomes quite severe, and there are a lot of planes that just will not recover from that.
Yeah, the F-14, we would do a subtle negative 4 G's eyeballs out, but then I know they would typically request to go to the highest level for another go, which would be negative 6 G's, 180 degrees per second, which is killer.
Oh my God! Wow.
Boom.
Wow.
Wow is freaking, and it's falling 10,000 feet per minute.
Oh my God.
It's dropping like a freaking rock, which is why in Top Gun, if you remember, they talked about the 10,000 foot hard deck, because we taught them, basically you're trying to break the angle of attack. So roll sass off, full opposite throw, you know, so there's a technique, and sometimes you hold it, you hold it, you hold it, well, you hold it, you hold it, you hold it, and okay, finally sure. It breaks. Yeah, and then once it breaks, you recover out of a, you know, out of the dive. But if you haven't done it by 10,000 foot hard deck, you know, above ground level, you have to punch out. And you can't do this. Negative 6 G's, you know, they basically have petechiae in the eyes, blood vessels are bursting. And this is in a centrifuge. I mean, these people come out sweating. Dang. You know, they're not allowed to fly the next day. You know, it was impressive to watch just how physical it was for, you know, we taught them they had to lock their harness. You know, because they would try it at 4 G's unlocked, and basically you're smashed up against the, you know, you can't hold yourself against 4 G's this direction, eyeballs out, let alone 6 G's. There's not a chance, you know. Mm. Yeah, so it was crazy. But there was one caught on Patuxent River on a camera. It was out on the training over Maryland, and it was in a flat spin, and I just happened to have a tracking camera, testing a camera, tracking it. And it's ding, 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 ding. And you see him punch out. Doink. You know, you see the canopy go. You see, you know, because that's how Goose died in Top Gun. He hit the canopy because it's a vertical fall, right? Normally, you punch out and the canopy goes behind you because you're still moving forward. So you can see, you know, the two seats come out, and then it changed the center of gravity of the airplane, and the airplane recovered as it went into the ocean.
Yeah,
just that center of gravity change of losing all the weight in the nose, it actually, and probably the thrust of being, because you basically got like on two little rockets as the seats leave, so it self-recovered.
So and if then you're interested crashed. In a single engine prop, if you're in a spin, it's pair, power off, ailerons neutral, rudder opposite direction, and
opposite, yeah.
It's the rudder. And the rudder will pull you out of a spin in an airplane. If you're in a twin, I think the guy was saying it, sometimes you become your own test pilot. And not at a very good time either.
Yeah, it's hopefully I've got altitude.
Yeah, that's some scary stuff. Fun, but scary. So this next story, entangled microwave photons may give 500 times boost to radar. So did this about 4 months ago. I think I did it about 8 months ago. This is quantum radar. Bum, bum, bum. This has been quantum radar bullshit. Quantum radar bullshit. This guy's like, look, guys, time out. There's something, he explains how it works, how it could work. There is something here, 500 times resolution of current radar. If you know current radar, they can pick up insects taking off sometimes, you know, big swarms of insects. So 500 times would just destroy stealth. But it requires a bunch of build up that we currently don't have. But quantum radar is some freaking awesome shit. And this quantum stuff is also going to be applicable probably to astronomy and a bunch of other stuff. And if you're interested, there's a technical explanation of why the naive way doesn't work, but they do a chirp that stretches the wavelength out, and it's a cool article. But yeah, quantum radar is not the bullshit. And if you don't believe it, send a letter to this guy.
Yeah, radar's pretty cool and crazy.
Yeah, he's a physicist. So there's a couple of good quantum stories. This is I guess I would call it a scientific opinion essay. And what she is saying is, we talk about probability fields and quantum mechanics and there being a moment in which they resolve into a particle. Her opinion is that's all just bullshit. Everything. There are no particles. It's all just a wave in a higher dimension. There's nothing. We think there are particles, but there are no particles at all. And I can see where she's coming from. I don't know the math, but it sounds pretty cool.
Interesting, professor of philosophy.
Yeah, always start mucking some stuff up. So, coming back to Earth, mass production of revolutionary computer memory moves closer with Ultra RAM on silicon wafers.
Sounds like a superhero.
Ultraman.
Yep. It looks like a giant bighorn sheep. He wears big horns.
It's a superhero called Ultraman. Comes with a cape, and it'll be kind of cool. Hey, it's a box, a little cape, maybe a little U on the front.
and they strike down the enemy by hitting them with their.
Yeah, he never forgets anything because he's Ultraman.
And that too, yeah.
So this is a new type of RAM. I'm guessing 10, 15 years from the market, it will be 100 times faster than flash. It will be persistent up to, I think they said, 1,000 years. So this would be some really, really super cool stuff. Yeah, it's at the bottom of the last paragraph. Cycle endurance, cycling time, 10 million cycles, which is 100 to 1,000 times better than flash. This is cool tech that there's so much money in this, they're going to have to develop it. They can not run any problems.
Yeah, that's crazy.
If you're interested, for those folks out there watching this, if you're interested in quantum stuff, I really love this essay. It's called The Second Quantum Revolution, and it's understandable for the layman. It's basically just, hey, you know, we're in this second wave of doing quantum stuff that's going to be just as incredible as the first wave. And the first wave was like transistors and all the, you know, computers we currently have. So the second wave is going to be even wilder. It's a good overview. So this next article, and I know I've got a bunch because we ended up going 2 weeks. Reddit co-founder says play-to-earn crypto games will be 90% of the gaming market in 5 years. So this is going to stretch your mind a bit here. This is Web3. It's everybody. We also have the bullshit Web3, bullshit Web3. They're fighting this over the same thing. The idea is that Web3 is you take your cryptographic blockchain with you for different places, and that's your identity, and you own that. This guy's saying that you load up a Donkey Kong 17 or whatever, and you play for 10 hours, and you get an upgraded Mario and all this stuff. Well, that is something you spent 10 hours on. You deserve some money for that, bub. And you can sell it to other people. It's a piece of merchandise. It's as much as cryptocurrency. And he's saying that, God bless me, I think he's right. It's going to be such that you're going to play games to make money.
Well, I guess choice between Factorio or Cryptorio. Yeah, you probably would have chosen the one that.
My daughter has.
Maybe I get a little payback.
Yeah, my daughter had. Were you here when I talked about my daughter's game where the game involves sitting in a chair?
Yeah, I think I remember you telling a story. I don't remember.
She gets money. Yeah, you play the game, and she does it here on Discord, and you sit in the chair. It's a video game that you get different chairs, and you sit. What a wonderful country, my friend. A wonderful country. I come from far away. Make money sitting in chair. Yeah, I don't know. But to kind of break the tech down, there are sort of two paths that tech are currently taking. Path one is the first article we had early on. It's the Matrix guys with the I own encrypted stuff end to end. This is I control my own life and who I talk to. These guys are, hey, I've got this blockchain wallet I carry with me. And by the way, somebody's probably going to own the code to get into the blockchain and get out. and they're going to want their VIG when you start playing with the blockchain. So expect these guys to say, hey, this is freedom. You can make money sitting in chairs and such. And they're going to get 10% off of everything, or 20%. God knows what they'll ask for. But this is looks to me like yet another walled garden situation setting itself up in 5 to 10 years. I like this next article quite a bit as well. Lessons in Game Design, Civilization, War Games. This is a retired Marine, either colonel or general, who worked at the War College. And he basically went back and looked at Sid Meier's Civilization game, which turned 20 this past week, 30, and talks about how wargaming could learn lessons from Sid Meier's Civilization game.
That's funny, because I happen to have been up in the attic looking for something goofy. And then look, here's my board games from late 70s, early 80s. I don't know, like France 1940 and Panzer Blitz and Avalon Hill, I think. Those maybe not as sophisticated as Civilization, but yeah, that's funny.
We are big on board games here. I just got a message from Scott Ambler, and Scott says the login error for Discord came back as invalid. Oh, dang.
I'm sure there's ways to get around that.
Yeah, hang on, let me see. 1 minute, please. So I click here, then I go link. I should know how to do this. I was trained. Invite people. There we go. Yep, copy. Okay, and then thanks, you guys. Thanks for coming by.
Okay. Maybe you need to get your merit badge.
I think the link times out. Merit badge.
The Discord merit badge. I saw something for Miro. I don't know if you use Miro, but the whiteboard thing. I saw something in my email about, hey, you can get some Miro badges for your profile if you. I don't know. I didn't look much past that. I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, don't care.
Well, this gets to this thing this Reddit guy's talking about. Is everybody in Discord's the same way? Everybody wants to gamify whatever their app is. They want to make it sticky so people come back, and then they want a VIG off or whatever the thing, and they want to build a walled garden. It's the same. They're running the same playbook that Facebook ran on us years and years ago. They need to come up with something different, because I think most of us are onto this. But yeah,
I do Duolingo.
Ah, cool.
I've been trying to learn Spanish, and I'm on, I don't know, consecutive day 705 or something.
Whoa,
like that.
Wow.
However, what's funny is it has, you're in like, you have different levels. You can get up to like Diamond League or, Obsidian or Ruby and stuff like that. And really the whole point is just for you to do the exercises and practice and learn, right? And doesn't matter really what rank you are or anything like that. But I think my wife often says I'm competitive. So for me, it does help sometimes. Like, I'm at the cutoff where I might get dropped back to the prior league. So, Sunday night or something like that, I might just hammer it and try to make sure I stay, get a high enough score that no one's going to kick me out. Even though, what's it matter? I can still practice more, but that just made me practice more. So it's a gamification is a funny thing that can certainly work to encourage for a certain type, yes. Maybe me, to do stuff. So yeah, it is a kind of a fascinating effect on a certain segment of the population.
I completely agree with you. I think that there's a slippery, big slope here. What I see happening, first of all, there are people who are cognitively unable to understand what you just said. But then there's a whole swarm of people who get into an application based on some sort of social or ephemeral benefit. Discord, I can chat with my friends. There's this guy I saw who made $10,000 on Discord. and they get in for some sort of vague nebulous thing, and then they buy into the idea that using the app is, like you're saying, leveling up on the thing. So the better you use the app, the more likely you are for this nebulous goal to be achieved.